This is part two of the podfic of the Sherlock Holmes crackfic AU snippet series, which possibly was titled A Taste of Things to Come and possibly not. In any case, this is part two of the podfic of Toft's Sherlock Holmes crackfic AU series. Six. You are the cream in my coffee. And, sir, you may wish to remember that no gentleman with a true understanding of coffee would ever half fill his cup with milk. The door slammed, and my newest employee strode back towards the counter, leaving the youngest son of the Earl of Winsborough lying dazed, but not, thank God, bloodied, on the cobblestones. The other customers, an elderly colonel, two young ladies and their chaperones, four Salvation Army members, and a young city man writing furiously in a ledger, looked up in astonishment. "Good Lord, man," I said with some heat, "is this your idea of drumming up business? We have barely been open a week. We can't afford to have you throwing customers out into the street. I heard no disturbance in this shop. What on earth was his crime?" "My apologies, Dr. Watson," Holmes said, smoothing his hair back from his face. There were two spots of color high on his cheeks, but otherwise his appearance was soon immaculate. He suddenly seemed to notice that I was out of my chair and leaped to my side. "Please do sit down, doctor. I will explain." He offered his arm, and, reluctantly, I allowed myself to be helped back to my armchair. Even this small activity caused me not a little discomfort, and I could not help a sigh of relief as my injured leg was relieved of its burden. When I opened my eyes, I found him scrutinizing me. "Well, Holmes?" I snapped, my temper made sharper by embarrassment. He gave no reaction, but said, "Did you know that young Mr. Tees Rollitt plays cards for high stakes?" "I did not," I said, surprised. "But if we turn away every gambler in London, we will have a very small number of customers left. This is a coffee house, not a church." "You misunderstand me," Holmes said. "He has a reputation among several other London establishments for refusing to pay his bills. When I gave him his cup of Moroccan roast, I noted the crumpled gambling slip on the floor beside him. It was clearly not a winner, or he would still have had it in his wallet. I then noticed the slight motion in his coat pocket. He had a mouse." "A mouse!" I shuddered. "Since Afghanistan, I have a horror of rodents." "Rather than wait for him to cause a scene and possibly disturb Mrs. Hudson..." I appreciated his tactful omission of myself, although he must have noticed my dismay. "Or cause a scandal by accusing him, I thought it best to have a fit of artistic temperament. Such scenes tend to enhance the reputation of an establishment rather than diminish it. Do you feel that I acted wrongly?" "By no means," I said quickly. "You thought very fast, and you have saved me a great deal of trouble. Thank you, Holmes." He gave a quick smile and nodded, then left me to reflect on his peculiarities. I have called him my employee, but, truth be told, at our first meeting I felt quite as if he were interviewing me for a position. Mrs. Hudson had managed the small coffee house for my late uncle for many years, but the previous coffee buyer and blender, a Mr. Jebediah Simpson, had disappeared with a large amount of my uncle's revenue while on a buying trip to the West Indies, a shock to my uncle, which no doubt contributed to his sudden death by apoplexy. And thus the establishment I inherited was like a surgical bag without a stethoscope. Despite my weak constitution, I took it upon myself to engage a coffee blender, with Mrs. Hudson's assistance. The woman is a very capable housekeeper, and her cakes and biscuits are beyond compare, but my uncle had run the coffee part of the business, and I did not think it fair to lay such a responsibility solely on her shoulders. It was quite by chance that I came across Holmes, through an old friend of mine from St. Bart's, who frequented a number of London coffee houses. "He is pretty abrasive," my friend had warned me, "but he mixes the best damned roast in all of London." On our meeting, the latter fact was certainly confirmed. As for the former, no doubt Mr. Tees Rollitt would agree. But I must admit that I found Holmes, well, rather more charming than I could admit, even to myself. "Dr. Watson," he said, startling me from my reverie. He instantly laid a hand on my shoulder to stop me from getting up. "I do beg your pardon," he said, contrite. "I have something for you." He pressed a hot mug into my hand. A rich, bitter smell rose from it. He interlaced his fingers under his chin, his eyes blazing with barely contained excitement. "Holmes," I said slowly, "is this the new beans from Indonesia?" "Yes." I inhaled deeply, as Holmes had taught me, then made to take a sip, but his cool fingers wrapped around my own and held the cup back from my lips. His touch transfixed me, and my eyes flew to his. I do not know what he read in them, but his own gray eyes widened a little, and his fingers tightened on my own. An endless moment seemed to pass. "Doctor," he said at last, a strange edge to his voice, "I am afraid you will burn yourself." My heart, pounding with startled hope, believed he was speaking of more than just the coffee. Holding his gaze, I whispered, "I will be careful." A loud burst of laughter came from the front of the shop, and Holmes released me instantly, springing back. Nobody entered, and to dispel the awkward moment, I blew on the hot liquid and finally drank. "Holmes," I said in frank amazement, "this is wonderful." For an instant, I saw a delighted, unguarded smile cross his features before he assumed a more urbane air of satisfaction. "Let us hope it will be enough to draw in customers," he said. "I am sure it will," I said fervently. I took another sip and closed my eyes as the smoky taste transported me to warmer climes. When I opened them again, Holmes was very close. "I have found, Doctor, that one can tell a great deal about a man from his reaction to excellent coffee," he murmured. "I deduced a large number of facts about you from yours before we had even been introduced." "Oh," I said, my heart in my throat. His knees brushed against mine, sending shivers through me. "What did you deduce about me?" "That you had come lately from Afghanistan, where you were in the army," Holmes murmured. "That you had been trained as a physician and had been extremely unwell of late. That I would rather work for you than any man in London. And that you might not be averse to me kissing you, given the right circumstances. Are these the right circumstances?" "Yes," I breathed, and he did. I have never again drunk coffee without remembering that first glorious taste of his mouth. The success of our establishment is often attributed to Holmes' coffee and Mrs. Hudson's excellent cakes, but I credit myself with no small part of this. As it turns out, Holmes has a habit of discovering coffee recipes in his sleep, but he rarely wakes enough to remember them in the morning. I have begun to keep a notebook by the bed. 7. Musical chairs. A dull flash filled the room, and the three men sprang back from the device. "For God's sake, Holmes, now I'm Lestrade!" Watson cried. He paused, then winced, and shuffled the police inspector's body from foot to foot in a most uncharacteristic way. "I say, Lestrade, you really ought to see a physician about these piles." Lestrade glared, his usual irritation far more impressive on Holmes's face. "You can keep your observations about my back passage to yourself, Doctor, if you please. Speaking of which, what on earth have you been doing to make yours so..." "Yes, all right, Inspector, point taken," Watson said quickly. "Holmes, can you fix this or not?" Holmes rubbed his temples wearily, then nearly poked himself in the eye and cursed. "Hell! Watson, your forehead is altogether too small. I don't know how you stand it." "Very well, gentlemen, if you would place your palm against that panel, Watson, and if you could place your hand here, we will try again." Another flash. The three looked at each other cautiously. "Well," Lestrade said at last, "everyone where they're supposed to be?" Holmes heaved a sigh and collapsed into a chair, covering his face with his hands. "Forgive me, gentlemen, if I say that at this moment I never wish to see either of you ever again." "You'll hear no protests from me," said the police inspector grimly, putting on his hat. "Next time you want subjects for your little experiments, Mr. Holmes, you will find I am previously engaged. Good day to you both."
A silence followed his departure.
"A singular experience, Watson," Holmes said at last, lighting his pipe with slightly trembling fingers, "and not one I care to repeat. Perhaps it may make for a particularly interesting monograph in a few years."
He turned.
"Watson?" "I don't know what you're looking at me for," Watson said. "I'm Lestrade."
When Watson had stopped laughing long enough to prevent Holmes from choking to death on his pipe stem, a short but vigorous tussle ensued on the living room floor, which ended in the sad demise of one of Mrs. Hudson's vases, and, some minutes later, the rather more satisfactory little deaths of the participants.
"I'm sorry," Watson said later, staring up at the living room ceiling, one hand idly stroking inside Holmes' half-open shirt, "that I did not get more of a chance to enjoy being you. I have always wondered what it is like."
"You would have quite ruined my reputation if you'd been me in any professional capacity," Holmes said lazily.
"I would reciprocate the sentiment, except that in my short time in your body I discovered that your shoulder is far more stiff than you let on, and that being devastatingly attractive is not nearly as exciting as I had imagined."
"I'd have thought you'd have had a lifetime to learn the latter," Watson yawned. "And my shoulder is not so bad. Besides, you did not get to test run my other features. My hair is very easy to clean, and my nipples are quite excellent."
"So I have observed," Holmes said. He was thinking, and as he had no other convenient surface nearby, he tapped his fingers on Watson's thigh to aid him in the process.
"I believe," he said at last, "that my monograph might require more data for conclusive results."
"Oh," said Watson, all innocence. "Shall I call back Inspector Lestrade? Or Mrs. Hudson?"
"That will not be necessary," said Holmes, climbing on top of him and divesting himself of his shirt. "For this stage of the experiment, we shall decrease the variables to 2.
"And who," Watson inquired, breath hitching, "will be the control?"
"Me, I think," Holmes said, and grinned.
8. Unnatural Desires.
"Holmes!" I cried, appalled.
Holmes made a violent effort to pull the bedclothes over the evidence of his shame, but I had already seen too much.
"Damn it, Watson," he said in a low tone, "I had hoped you would not find out this way."
He allowed me to pull the sheet aside. I realized now that I had never seen him out of trousers, and that he always wore his slippers indoors. He had clearly been polishing his hooves with the cloth in his hand, and the hair on his legs was thick and brown. He thrust my hand aside and stood up, turning so that I could see the full picture, his goat legs, his tail.
"Well, Watson," he sneered, "what do you think of this medical impossibility?"
"You're magnificent, Holmes," I breathed. "I have always thought so. Your tail, may I touch it?"
I had never seen Holmes flush, but he did so now. He remained quite still while I stroked my fingers along his tail, his expression unreadable.
"Watson," he whispered at last, "am I to take it that all this time I have been unaware that you are a fawn fancier?"
"I cannot deny it," I said, my voice thick. "Holmes, what fools we are, to think that I have been clandestinely attending clubs, taking foolish risks to fulfill my unnatural urges, when I had you here, concealing your hooves in these ridiculous slippers. Make love to me, man."
"Not entirely a man," Holmes said with strange triumph, and he cast off his robe and stood bare before me.
"No," I murmured. "A god."
The end for now.